fasten your seatbelts this time around. Our next speaker is going to provide you with some very exciting, compelling information. Art Campbell has been, two speakers as a matter of fact, Art Campbell has been interested in UFO research since the 1950s. He was an early NICAP investigator, investigation committee for aerial phenomenon, and chairman of NICAP chapter in Kansas City, Missouri. In the 50s, he worked with the founder of that organization, Donald Kehoe, and I believe, thank you, we made contact with former President Truman in the spring of 1958 at the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri. And Kehoe's subsequent letter to President Truman begins Mr. Campbell's book called UFO Crash at San Augustine. Did a UFO crash on the plains of San Augustine in 1947?
Presenting along with Art is Bill Kirkland. He was an Air Force medic and high-altitude chamber specialist stationed in Holloman Air Force Base in 1955. Kirkland learned of several eyewitness reports of President Eisenhower at Holloman on or about February 11, 1955, in Ike's third year of his first term. What transpired at that time has drawn Bill and Art into an extraordinary journey of research and discovery. Whatever success the exopolitical activism of the disclosure movement does have, it will not have been possible without decades of work by hundreds of researchers like the two presenters you're going to see today. So please welcome to X Conference 2009 Art Campbell and Bill Kirkland.
It's really a privilege to be here. We've heard a lot about the X Conference west of the Mississippi, but not too many of us could get here. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Kirkland, his background. He's a graduate of Montebello High School in California, and he was, as Stephen mentioned, a high-altitude chamber specialist, and he was trained at Gunther Air Force Base in Alabama in the early 50s. He attended Long Beach State College and had a major in applied math and physics. He worked for North American Aviation in Burbank, California, Collins Radio at Newport Beach, Montebello Lockheed Missile and Montebello, sorry, California, Lockheed Missile and Space in Houston, Texas for NASA, and he worked on the Apollo 14 simulator in Houston. He's a retired executive from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Has 25 years in computer and 4 years in the military service. He served your government and mine for 29 years. It's my great privilege to present to you Mr. Bill Kirkland.
I don't know whether you're aware of this, but you're going to hear hearsay information that'll never get any of these people who withhold the truth in criminal or in criminal courts, you know. So we'll talk about this. Before I start, I would like to thank Steve and Cheryl for setting this up, and I feel like I'm honored to be with you talking about this. 1955, when I was at Holloman and Eisenhower landed there, I didn't believe this for 40 years. I didn't believe any of this until 1995, okay? And you're going to hear the story. I was stationed at George Air Force Base at Victorville, California. And while I was there, Eisenhower landed at Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino. A friend of mine who went to the same school that I was Ben Luth, and Ben went with the ambulance down to Norton to protect the Eisenhower train in case something went in, or a plane in case some accident took place. When he got back, I asked him, Ben, what happened? And he said, Eisenhower landed, met some of the officials, he said, went aboard a C-45. I didn't know what a C-45 was. I had to find out. he says, and then headed off towards Palmdale or towards Edward or Muroc, depending on how you wanted to look at it. That's the wrong way from Palm Springs. It's to the northwest, and Palm Springs is to the east of Norton. When I was at George Air Force Base, Edwards was only cut down twice. Once when a test pilot by the name of Connors was killed, and the other time was about this time when Eisenhower was there. I didn't know why it was cut down. I thought and wondered what test pilot lost his life. The information that I just gave you on George has been verified by Dr. Michael Sala, and you can check with him about that. When I went to Holloman Air Force Base, because George Air Force Base didn't have a high altitude chamber, so I went to Holloman and worked at the AeroMed Laboratory under Colonel John Paul Stapp, the guy who drove the rocket sled. There were four flight surgeons at Holloman. John Paul Stapp was one, David Simons was another, and there was a hospital commander, a lieutenant colonel, I can't remember his name, and Dr. Robert Reiner, who was a captain. I went to Reiner's office from the AeroMed Laboratories because I did not keep chicken eggs alive. I didn't put any water in an incubator, and they died. Now, David Simons wrote a kind of bad letter for me so that I'd get out of there. And he did the right thing because I'm not a lab person. I'm a person. Okay? When I went to work for Dr. Reiner, I worked in the flight surgeon's office there. Dr. Reiner was the best man that I have ever worked for in my life. Marvelous man. While I was there, Eisenhower was going to land one day, and in the winter, February, Holloman Air Force Base has got a code that unless in the wintertime, everything is normally khakis. Unless you're doing base operations work and are an officer of an official standing on the base, then you wear blues. That's in the wintertime. So the story that I'm telling you, the difference between khakis and blues is very important. When Eisenhower was supposed to land, the day before he was to come in, a parade to honor him was canceled. The President of the United States is entitled to full military honors at any base that he lands on. And that means a parade. Dr. Reiner asked me if I wanted to go to the parade, and I said no. He says, okay, you're working. Well, the work schedule of Eisenhower didn't show up. The parade didn't show up. So I just went to work like normal. And when I went there, there was a nurse who worked there that said, Kirkland, where's Dorsey? Dorsey Moore was the airman in charge of our little group. He wasn't an officer, he was an airman. And I said, I don't. And just then, Dorothea Thorensen, who was our clerk typist, said, I saw him take his wife down to the commissary. He'll be back in about 15 or 20 minutes. I just kept quiet after that, you know. When Dorsey came in about 15 minutes later, he said, Kirkland, did you see what's out at the on the flight line? I said, what is it? He says, it's a disc, hovering disc. I'm thinking disc that you can throw 12 inches maybe, wooden with a steel rim. The only thing that I knew that hovered other than that was a helicopter and the Navy's hovercraft. And I'm saying, oh. I said, what's it made of? He says, metal, like polished aluminum, polished steel. He said, you know, metal. I said, how big is it? He said, 20 to 30 feet. I said, no, I haven't seen it. He said, "You want to see it?" I said, "Yes." I said, "I'd like to see it." He said, "Go out to the front of the hospital," he says, "and look down at the flight line." He said, "You'll see it." I said, "With my luck," I said, "I would go out there and it wouldn't be there." He said, "I wouldn't say that." He says, "I took my wife to the commissary. It was there 30 minutes later when I left." And I said, "Well, I'll ask." In a base where there's war conditions, regardless of where you're at, you're on 24/7. And if you leave your assigned spot, that's against the law, military law. So I asked the nurse, who had asked the doctor, if I could go out to the front and see it. She looked at the doctor, and the doctor said no, so I didn't go. 9 o'clock, go for coffee. Coming back from coffee, I'm following two young pilots. The one on the left is in khakis, the one on the right is in blues. The one on the left said, "Why the blues?" He says, "I'm the officer of the day." He says, "I've been down at base ops all day." He said, "Waiting for the plane to come in." He said, "Air Force One?" He said, "Yes." Air Force One, that was the first time I heard Air Force One. I didn't know what it meant. I had to ask that too. Well, in the 60s, that was very common. But in the 40s, it was the first time I heard it. He says, "Well, what happened?" He said, "He landed, he turned around on the active and shut down. And we were told to turn off our radar." "Why were you told to turn off your radar?" "I don't know." He said, "We were told to turn it off, so we turned them off." And then the guy in the khaki said, "I heard that the one that was brought down at Roswell was brought down with Doppler radar." And he said, "I don't know." They continued talking. What happened after that? He said, "They came out over the mountains across the proving ground, White Sands Proving Ground, across the monument, and the guy on the left, again, the khaki guy, said, "I heard one landed at the monument." He said, "The other one said, I don't know about that. I'm telling you what I saw." He says, "Two of them came over. One landed on the reactive in front of the plane, and the other one hovered overhead like it was protecting that plane." He got out of his plane, walked to the UFO, and the door opened, and he walked inside. How long was he in there? About 40 or 45 minutes. "Could you see? Were they grays?" He says, "I couldn't see. I didn't have binoculars." "Who had the binoculars?" "The tower." "Could they see?" "No, they didn't have the angle." This is all going on while I'm walking behind them, probably no more from here to the lobby area. And as they were doing this, one of them said, "Did you see," the one on the left again, "did you see the autopsy film?" And the one on the right said, "Yes." "Do you think it's real?" "I don't know." So it was available in 55. And he said, "Well," he said, "does electronic waves, radio waves go through plastic?" He said, "Why do you ask that?" He said, "Because I think there's a radar unit in the nose of that airplane." And I'm saying, "Who are you talking about?" I said, "Are you pilots?" And they shut up, turned around so I couldn't read their names, and walked on. I went to the flight surgeon's office. At 11 o'clock, I went like I normally did to pick up the mail. Picking up the mail, a new officer, supply officer, said, "Kirkland, I've been looking for you." He said, "Did you see anything down on the flight line?" I said, "No, but I'm qualified for emergency operation, first raid, all of this, graduated top of my classes." And I said, "No. Do you need help?" He said, "No, I just wondered." At noon, you know, Dorsey didn't show up after lunch. The nurse and Dorothea Thorenson both asked me, "Where's Dorsey?" I said, "I don't know. Sometimes if we're not too busy, he goes home and eats. He'll be here in a few minutes." 2:30 shows up, 2:45. Dorsey's not there at 2:30, but about 2:45 he shows up. I'm walking out for coffee, and I say, Dorsey, where have you been? He says, at a meeting. I says, well, you better tell Dorothea and the nurse because they're wondering where you're at. After work, I'm in my barracks room and I'm called outside to the back of the barracks because Air Force One is flying over the residential area at Holloman Air Force Base. That's a no-fly area zone. I ran out, looked for it. I had to jump up because the plane was flying low and it just passed over the roof of our building. Air Force One flew from Holloman at about, 4 o'clock, maybe 4:30. After that, I waited until supper. And from supper, I went out and I looked at the flight surgeon's office and the lights were on. I said, I wonder what's going on, because part of my job is to check and make sure the lights go on. So I walked over and there was Captain Reiner talking to a lieutenant colonel who was in blues. And he said, the colonel was talking, he said, Bob, he said, I was there on stage with him, standing room only, 225 people in supply hangar. Bob said, Captain Reiner said, that he had heard that he had talked at the base theater. He said he might have been, because he only spoke for a couple minutes, and then he left, and the base commander spoke for about 20. He could have had plenty of time to go over the base theater and come back. He said, but I'm telling you is what I saw. Standing room only in the supply hangar, 225 people each time it was there. And I said, who talked? He said, the commander-in-chief. I said, the president. He said, the commander-in-chief. You don't ask a lieutenant colonel again if it was the president. So I knew that. I said, what did he talk about? He says, it's classified. I said, how is it classified? Confidential? He says, higher. I said, secret. He said, higher. I said, oh. He says, what's the O? I said, I'm only classified to secret. It's none of my business. And he says, I would not say that if I were you. Okay? About 3 months after that, I was getting ready to go overseas, and I asked a bunch of guys that were there, and because I said, I have never heard a president talk. Have any of you ever heard a president talk? They said, yes. One of them said, yes. I said, who? He said, Eisenhower. I said, where? He said, the base theater. And another airman said, hey. And the conversation stopped, just like that. That was in 1955. I didn't believe in these things for 40 years. 1995, I was listening to a man by the name of Mike Murphy, Kansas City. And Mike Murphy was interviewing a guy by the name of Bob Dean. But Mike kept calling him Bob O'Day. Don't ask me why, I'm just saying that he did. Bob Dean said that he had talked to a man who was a crew member aboard Air Force One that landed at Holloman. And Holloman got at Holloman, Eisenhower got out and went aboard a UFO. I said, my God, I was there. I became a believer. And I started putting together this information and tried to give it to various people. I got some of the information to Mike Murphy and was interviewed on radio 3 times. I sent a letter of some of this material to Stan Freeman, and I got back a mimeographed thing that said he wanted to buy, do you want to buy my books? I'm not really interested in his books, The reason I'm not interested in his books is because I know Eisenhower met with UFOs. Okay, so on Linda Moulton Howe was on Mike Murphy's radio show. And I called in and offered her the same information. And no, she was doing her thing. She never called back. She never wanted any of this information. So I went to the Ozarks later on, meeting there, and saw Linda Moulton Howe. And I was and said, I just wanted to see what you look like, and that was all. She was doing her own thing and still does her own thing, you know, not related to my incidents at all, and she wasn't interested. So nobody was really interested at all. But when I was graduated from Long Beach, I worked at North American, and I worked at Burbank and Lockheed. I worked on the Blackbird. And then from there, I went to Motorola and worked as a scientific computer specialist for an analog group, Ed Groth by name. This is kind of interesting, too. Ed said that the electronic people had told him that they had made a 120 to 150-year jump. I said, how? He said, by backward engineering a foreign object. I said, Russian? He said he didn't know where it came from, but it was backward engineered. About a week later, an electrical engineer told me that the guys who were doing the backward engineering had said that what they were backward engineering was a computer. And this computer carried 30 digits of accuracy. Where do you need 30 digits of accuracy? Only terrestrial. Only interstellar. You don't need it on this Earth. From there, I went back to Collins Radio. And from Collins Radio, I went to Houston working for Lockheed's Missile and Space. I worked on the trainers. And while I was there at the trainers, it was very interesting because another incident took place. Wally Serrar worked in the same office that I did, only he had a view of the outside. I worked in an inside cubicle. It wasn't very nice, okay, by comparison. The astronauts, and this is hearsay because I was not there, but I was told by somebody that did. The astronauts were told that they should not talk about any kitchen items flying, like pancakes, dishes, or cups. Saucers were not mentioned. Do you understand what I mean, he said. You're not to talk about this among yourselves, your wives, your family, or anyone by radio or on the radio. Oh, yeah. Okay. Wally Serrar is up in space, circling the Earth, and he says, Houston, there is a Santa Claus. The boys went around the moon, came back out from the far side, and another astronaut said, there is a Santa Claus, and he's big. Now, how big he was, I never figured out until I heard at Laughlin this year that two Navy men had seen a craft come out of the water about a mile and a half away from them that was 3 to 5 times the size of an aircraft carrier. That's big. It carries about 10,000 people. The question is whether it's ours or theirs. Okay? Now, the verification of my story at Holloman was done by Art Campbell, and Art has recorded information of a woman whose father became a fireman. So, what? Art?
We will put on the electrician's daughter, please. This lady contacted me as a result of an article in the UFO magazine.
And I brought out some memorabilia stuff.
Speaking now.
To show you. Oh, here's Billy. Yeah, that's and that's
she's
my
going
brother.
To her personal memorabilia prior to reading a letter from
when
father.
Dad was in the single core at Camp Gordon, and he loved to climb his poles. There he is with his friend Jim, and that he was practicing going up and down. And there he is again working at the cleaning the weapons and getting message pickup. And oh, here's some of his Nebraska fan memorabilia that he loved so much. And he had this with him with every he had a few plane crashes, and he always had this picture with him. He was very fond of his religion. And this is a current events school newspaper that we used to get every week. This was from in the week of February to March 2nd of 1956, and it was showing these Air Force balloons that were going up. It was every other day in Hollerman. We used to just run around and we didn't know that there was anything exciting to know about it. We just thought it was very normal. Oh, and here's some pictures. My dad loved also to do photography, and here is this is Dad at it was with Nixon and Agnew in 1972, and this is in Omaha. Nixon was in here in Omaha in 1970, and he got invited to the inaugural ball. And he didn't have his flash, and he was so upset. But there is his own picture, and he was quite involved with the party. He used to fly the Republicans locally when he moved here in the late 60s. He flew the party members to meetings over southeast Nebraska, and then when Nixon came, he flew the Republican National Committee members in 1970 when they were stumping for Nixon, and. He suggested that they talk about the Nebraska football because they played in the Orange Bowl in 69 for the national championship. And so Nixon started his speech in Omaha with Dad's idea about bringing up football. And he also played in Tarkio because he was a stocky person. He loved his football. But anyway, there's some other things here. So I've got some letters right here. I'm sure I'll find that one. Yeah, here's the one that Mom and Dad wrote. Okay, that's Auburn, Nebraska, October 26, 1989. Dear kids, it's beautiful fall here with the usual pumpkins up and down the main drag. Kids are getting excited. Your father and I are doing well. Heard from Helen. She said the grandchild came on time, and although Sharon was in labor, you don't need to talk about that. Anyway, Dad has just come from the kitchen with a cup of coffee, and he says he doesn't mind telling the fireman's story again, but you kids know it better after all these years. But he'll recall what he can. All right, this is the part. Well, you kids and Mom moved down from Albuquerque, I think it was in the summer of 1954. As you recall, I had taken the Hollerman job that previous winter, and Mom wanted us all together, so we rented a place over near Dudley Elementary School on Maryland, wasn't it? Remember, you kids could walk to school. You were in the fourth grade, and Billy was in first or second. Anyhow, sometime after Christmas of 55, we were told President Eisenhower was coming. So George, our boss then at the electric shop, went to a meeting to find out more. He would not be inspecting anything, and they said, just carry on as usual. If you see the president, don't gawk, wave, or anything, just carry on. So the day the president came, we went out in the truck to a job where we were replacing some wire down the flight line. It was really old stuff, but that put there in World War II, and safe. So we heard the president's plane in the morning lining up for an approach and watched it land on the far runway. So we waited for it to taxi over to the flight line so we could see him. But we didn't hear it anymore, and it had shut down somewhere out there. So we went ahead and pulled wire for a while, and one of the men, I believe it was Charlie, said he can see out there from that pole over there. So why don't one of us go up the pole and see where the plane is? Well, I had my climbers on, and I started to unbuckle them and was waiting to give them to the first volunteer. When someone said I should do it, as people were used to seeing me up on the poles anyway. So I started up with my back to the sun, a safety measure, which also put my back to the runway where we thought as Connie was. Connie was a nickname for the big constellation the president flew. As I started up, some of the guys reminded me not to gawk, and I heard them laugh. A few minutes later, I heard some shouting, and some guys tarring a hangar roof nearby started to run, pointing out to the runways. Then I heard our truck start up and some of the crew jumped in with one or two running after it. And they were pointing out to the flight line, and so I decided to turn around on the pole to see what the ruckus was about, and I could not believe what I saw. There was this pie tin-like thing coming at me about 150 feet away. I thought it was remote controlled or something. 25 to 30 feet across, and I started down the pole as fast as I could go. I was up about 40 feet, and I threw my climbing rope out, gave it slack, and only touched the spike on each side of the pole 3 or 4 times on each side in before I got to the bottom. While I was running towards the big hangar, I looked back, and it had stopped and was just sitting there. Well, when we all got back to the shop and we had a good lap, one of the guys who saw me come down said he got down that pole faster than a fireman. So as you kids were growing up and we had the family gatherings, you used to ask to tell me about the time I became a fireman. You know, I always wondered why we did not use that thing during Vietnam and so forth. And over the years, I realized if we had technology like that, it would have saved lots of lives. But I gradually realized that it had something to do with Ike being there that day. And it wasn't ours. It was an unwritten rule at Holloman, you didn't talk about what you saw. And after that day, it was seldom mentioned at the shop. I still have those climbers here someplace. Billy used to play with them. Remember? Mom here again. Well, Dad's wandered outside someplace. He said something about checking the pump. It's been sluggish lately. Dad thinks the motor's old and needs rewinding. He spends several hours a week up at Harold's helping out with mechanical and electrical stuff for farm equipment. Dr. Fornash says it's okay for Dad to drive a little around town, but to keep an eye on him. He thinks Dad has had a mini stroke or two, but should not do any highway driving at night. He drags his left foot a little, but gets out to the golf course in good weather, but he has to use a cart now. We're looking forward to seeing all of you at Christmas. Say hi to Bob and Warren for us, and hug the twins. All of our love, Mom and Dad.
Art and I got together over 3 years ago. Art's going to tell you how he got in contact with me. And there's another little vignette from somebody else that was at Holloman. Here's Art.
First, I want to tell you about the lady from Nehama County, I believe, southern Nebraska. She said, this is the second time she wrote the letter. She read the letter. First time she broke down in the middle of it. Her father died 2 months after the letter was written. It was the last letter. And she said, I got to make myself over and be back down in a couple minutes. She came down wearing a wig. She had beautiful salt and pepper hair, but anyhow, we went ahead and filmed it again. Bill didn't mention the fact that, I think he mentioned it, when Eisenhower's plane landed, it's a huge plane, it sits 10 feet off of the tarmac. You'd have to have a ladder to get in and out of it. And the plane usually was down at the end of the runway and taxis back around to the A part of the, there's an A section of the runway where the tower is. And then it comes to the VIP area where they were going to have the parade, which, by the way, was canceled, Bill mentioned. Well, Eisenhower's plane sat out on the runway as far as it could be. They closed the runway the whole day while the president was there, and Bill said he remembered seeing it about 4:45 or 5 in the afternoon, seeing the president's plane fly over over Holloman Air Force Base. So we're ready now for a man who flew into Holloman Air Force Base the day before Eisenhower arrived. We believe it was the 10th, around the 10th of February 1955. Was due to go out in the next morning, and they would not let him go, and they held up his plane for a whole day. He was a staff sergeant who was a loader on a cargo plane. This man saw Ike's plane land and heard President Eisenhower speak at Holloman, February 10th, 1955. Okay, ready for the airman, please, Sergeant Wyckoff. We've had to use pseudonyms for our people.
Air Force there in 1950, this was actually 1951, I was in an airplane accident, and I had another airplane accident where I split my head open, and it ruined my back. My wife had just lost her first child.
He was a tail gunner in World War II. 43
said,
missions over Japan.
You know you're due to go to Korea, but in your condition, if you volunteer for Bacalar Air Force Base out in Indiana, any other, that's where you go. So we were fortunate. We went there and stayed there. And my wife was pregnant with the second child. And I says, they can't send me overseas. Let's just stay in the next year, and then we'll get out. So that's what we did. While I was out in Indiana, my job was loading and delivering a cargo. We went to Washington, where they opened the new base with cargo, and just kind of anything they wanted, we would fly it.
What other bases did you go to?
Well, I went to March and Holman two or three times. We hauled what we think is stuff for the atomic bomb.
Dave, what do you recall about Holloman?
We had a haul a load of stuff down there, parts that they needed, and the runway is like this. And I never seen anything like that before. And anyway, as we were there, we saw Air Force One come in, and we didn't know who it was. And then an officer come around and says, you can't leave. And I said, well, President Eisenhower's here, and you can't leave the field until he's gone. And I says, you can hear him over the loudspeakers, but it didn't do any good, you know. I would have liked to have seen him. And this officer, we didn't have the clearance to go into the mess hall. And one of the other officers, a higher ranking officer, came to us and says, would you like to go in and eat and listen to a speech? And most of us said, yeah, because I'd like to see him. I didn't get to shake his hand or anything, but because I didn't have the right badge, clearance, to go in. But they did leave us go in at the very end, and we ate and listened to his speech.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was great. He had a lot of good ideas. Maybe he had some I disagreed with, but I don't agree with everybody anyway, you know.
Well, Dave, do you remember what date that was that you were there?
The reason I know when he was there is here's what I got discharged. He was there in mid-February of 1955. That was my last trip that I made while I was in the service. Then I was discharged, and I came back home to the Bay Area with my family.
I've kind of heard what we did, what we didn't do, and this is all hearsay, except for what these two people verified. We're about through with our presentation. If there's any question about this, you should remember that we got in contact with a couple of the people that I knew, David Simons and Kittinger, who I flew with. Now, these are the two men, David Simons who jumped from 108,000 feet. He's a medical doctor. And Kittinger, who jumped from 102,000 feet from a gondola, almost exceeded the speed of sound coming down. One denied it, and the other one didn't even bother to answer. Kittinger at least acknowledged that I hadn't gotten seasick, I mean sick, aboard his airplane. Okay? If there's going to be any questions, come on up, pick up one of the phones, and we'll answer to the best of our abilities.
Microphone in the center of the room. We have a few minutes left for questions. I would like to mention, while the first person is coming up, that this gentleman lives in the Bay Area. He's in a wheelchair and not in very good health. But he was one of the few people we were able to find that indicated that he had seen Eisenhower and heard him, seen the plane and heard him speak. He saw the plane land in the morning, and they were due to go out with Indiana back home, and they had closed the airport. And Bill told me that as soon as I came in, they parked the airplane at the far runway, and they closed it. They called it an active runway, and as long as Air Force One was parked at the far end, it was still active, even though the plane wasn't taking off. Stayed there, as far as we know, maybe till 10:30, 11:30, or 12, when we think it was towed back over to one of the hangars. We were in contact with eight guards. We know of eight guards. We found two alive and got information from one of them. Okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry. We were in contact with some Air Force One people. We were able to find a guard who was with the plane. Now, the plane was parked perpendicular to the UFO that landed in front of the plane. This is when the president got out and walked in for 40 minutes or so. So the air crew did not know what was happening because their airplane was parked perpendicular. We suspect that Colonel Draper, the pilot, knew, and one or two of the Secret Service agents. How we were able to determine how President Eisenhower got there, he went hunting in Georgia, at Thomasville, Georgia, where he'd been before. On the plane had 13 Secret Service agents. One of the Air Force men, one, told me that they only took four or five when Ike went hunting. Ike was going into the plantation of Secretary of Treasury Humphreys, whom he had appointed, and he stayed there because of his privacy, and the press couldn't go in or out of this plantation. Now, there were 30 reporters with Eisenhower, not on his plane, on a separate chartered plane. The Red Chinese were sailing Formosa. We were evacuating the islands of Quemoy, Matsu, and they called it the Formosa Crisis. Lyndon Baines Johnson in the Senate at that time put together a resolution that passed overwhelmingly in the Senate and in the House that we would go to war with Red China if they set a foot on Formosa. Eisenhower and Don Foster Dulles both said, "We will use nuclear weapons if you Red Chinese invade Formosa." Formosa is still free. It's now called Taiwan. Is anybody at the mic yet? Anybody at the mic yet? Back there? I can't see myself. So, we figured out that the 13 Secret Service agents, and he only traveled with five, he kept five at the plantation going in and out like he was there. And then he came down with a case of the sniffles and was not available for 33 hours. While he was having this severe case of the sniffles, he lands at Bill's Air Force Base, Holloman. He's there, we think, 6 or 7 hours. Now, he arrives back at Thomasville. They're having a big party. All the press for miles around have been invited by Secretary Humphrey to the Glen Avon Country Club in Thomasville, Georgia. Free booze, meal, entertainment, all the press in the country, for miles around, were at that party. Wouldn't have been a soul to see Ike land 25 miles north at Spence Air Force Base when he came back in.
Well, you've heard the story, and that's it. That's all there is.
Could you give us that name of him? We might be able to contact him at a later date.
Well, his name is George Green, and he produced and published the book, The New Paradigm. He also distributes a DVD called The Big Picture.
Now, I won't remember that, so if I get out there, would you please write it down for me?
Sure, I'll be happy to give you a copy of it. I have it. He invites us to reproduce it and distribute it to everybody, because it's exactly the same story that you just described.
Well, we haven't run on to one before, and we'd love to include it. We certainly would. I see a lady behind you there, or a gentleman with long hair. I can't tell which. All I see is a halo.
Okay.
Come on back up, Bill, will you?
The halo gives me away. Does this event with Eisenhower fit into any timeline you might, may have constructed in terms of what came after this, if this was...
There's some things that came afterwards that we're aware of that may or may not be connected. It's our understanding, at least mine, that the extraterrestrials are very interested in our nuclear progress. And they first started showing up a year or so after we dropped the nuclear bomb, the first one in set one off in Alamogordo. And I have a feeling that they may have been behind the early peace talks. Eisenhower went to one in July in Geneva, called Geneva One, in July of 1955. And Red China was there, Russia was there. And by the way, the Russians were changing governments, and you know, they were pretty shaky at that time. And Stalin's appointee at the time was Malenkov, had been replaced because he didn't make the five-year plan, which is one of many. And they were getting ready to replace him with Brezhnev, by the way, who was kind of a crony of Khrushchev. So we were having a Russian government change. At the same time, they were having the Red Chinese shelling Taiwan, and the president goes hunting. Incredible. Incredible. But as far as we know, that's the only aftermath of what may have happened. And I, of course, had his first heart attack in... September in Denver of that year, 55.
Sir, did either of you get any indication of what was the content of that speech? Because we'd like to be able to know if there was anything disinformationally spoken or some allusion to what he was actually there for.
I have no idea what was spoken. I really don't know anything that was said. I had no indications that there were people who even, you know, were going to talk. All I know is from the indications that the lieutenant colonel said in the flight surgeon's office, that the president had spoken. He had spoken about a subject that was top secret or higher, and the people that we contacted at Holloman that I knew of did not talk about this.
Where did that speech come from that the gentleman said, how was the speech, and he said, great, but nobody thinks
that was answer? That was in one of the dining rooms or something along that. I have no idea where he went and heard this. I have no idea, no recollection of that.
Okay.
But as an enlisted man, I'm very surprised that he didn't go to one of those established places, which is the fly hangar or the base theater. Those people took an oath not to reveal that the president was there and what they had seen.
Okay, thank you.
This is why when Bill was in a conversation in Dr. Reiner's office, he said the president and the lieutenant colonel corrected commander-in-chief. They weren't allowed to use the word president. And Bill said, you mean the president, the commander-in-chief is the president, or whatever he said. But in any case, they didn't want to use that word, although they had to acknowledge he was there. Everybody knew it. Everybody at the base knew he was coming, including all the civilians. There's 8,000 or 9,000 people there, about 4,500 enlisted people and officers, and a complete air wing is there also. They all knew he was coming, but with their communications in those days, there was no way that they communicate that back to Thomasville, Georgia, and they really didn't care. So all he had to do was make sure he came in and out of Thomasville in secret, because he had 30 international press, by the way, were cooling their heels at the Scott Hotel, cleaning out the bar and everything else they could. And Press Secretary Haggard came in and gave them daily briefings about the world situation in the Far East and the evacuation of the Tonshin Islands and the Kamoi Matsu situation and so forth. And they thought Eisenhower was at a cottage playing Scrabble and having hot toddies with Mamie.
Excuse me, sir.
I now know that all of you believe in Santa Claus, too.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to speak to y'all, speaking the truth. I've been studying this for like 2 years now, and it's been documented that Harry Truman had did a treaty with the Greys, suspectingly, and brought the Rockefellers in. You can check this out through William Cooper, Thomas Costello, and Phil Schneider. And when Truman left office, he had passed it down to Eisenhower. Now, the date that y'all was talking about in February 1955, Eisenhower was scheduled to be in a certain place, but it's documented that he had a toothache on the exact date, and it was supposedly said that he had went to Holloman Air Force Base. That he told the people, the news media, that he had a toothache, but he went to Holloman Air Force Base to have this meeting with the Gray.
You're mistaken in two areas. One, toothache took place in 1954 at Edwards Air Force Base. He never went to the doctor. That's been substantiated
right.
by several people.
Right.
And this Holloman instance took place in 1955.
Okay. And the question was about the treaty that was supposed to have been...
I don't know anything about a treaty, but our military was so afraid of the of what took place in 1938. 1938, War of the Worlds was broadcast as a news, as a radio show, as a news bulletin. And there's only two times in my life when I was younger that my father interfered with us listening to the radio. One was in 1938 when that was on, War of the Worlds. And the other one was December 7th in 1941 when Japan attacked us. Now, from those points, the military was very concerned that the public would go ballistic. They did go ballistic. So did the military. The military has never been able to stop these UFOs. And if you can't protect the country, what you're doing, because that's your job, how often will you tell the people the truth? The Germans and the Japanese both lied to their people when they could not stop the Allies from bombing them. We are no different than they are.
There was one positive thing that happened in 1938. Joe Lewis knocked out Max Smelly in 1 minute and 30 seconds of the first round. I remember that. My boy, my dad was hooping and hollering over the block. Smelling had beaten him in Germany a year before. Any other questions? I think I see another halo back there.
One question. Is there any consensus amongst people about what was discussed or agreed upon at this meeting?
Bill and I have talked consensus? About this, and we have some guesses. Bill had a good one, I believe. We think I may very well have seen UFOs and extraterrestrials, perhaps dead ones at Edwards. And this was his first chance maybe to get on a working UFO. He was only on there apparently 40 or 45 minutes. It wouldn't be a lot of time there to do negotiations or sign the treaty. But it would be a lot of high and by and have a drink or whatever. And so our guess is that he very well may have gone aboard just to see what one looked like. Eisenhower had the courage. There's certainly no doubt about it. And I've been told by people, you're really treading on sacred ground here. I know I am. Both Bill and I, Eisenhower was our president too. And we have high regard for the man. This just happens to be an incident in his life that we're talking about it, and no disregard whatsoever for our president at that time. But other possibilities would be, we had some ongoing, something that needed to be confirmed, something that needed to be reiterated. Somebody may have called somebody to a meeting. One guy came up to me and says, you know, I worked on the U-2, and we did not have U-2 flying in 1955 until September it was wind tunneled,
and the first flight tests were early December of 1955. He said, do you suppose Eisenhower had the extraterrestrials fly over Red China to make sure we weren't going to be, Formosa wasn't going to be invaded? Oh, that's an interesting point. Well, maybe they were our year two.
Everything else is just speculation. You know, you're talking about if they made treaties, if they're still in effect. I don't know. Do you? You know, let's get with it, people. We're through here, you know, really through. Let's go outside and smell the roses.
All right, folks, we're on time. A couple of quick things.